You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, November 23rd, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Astra Taylor, co-founder of the Debt Collective and author of the recent book Remake the World, Essays and Reflections and Rebellions on the State of Biden's Student Debt Loan Forgiveness Plan. Then we'll be talking to Sarah Moran. She is the U.S. Country Director for the charity Give Directly. Talk about not only Give Directly, but guaranteed basic income experiments going on around the country. Meanwhile, speaking of student loan repayments, Biden administration extends student loan repayments to August of 2023. They wait on a Supreme Court decision on their recent loan forgiveness. Meanwhile, seven people dead at a Walmart mass shooting, including the shooter. And the suspect in the Colorado Springs LGBTQ shooting, bar shooting, I should say, to appear in court. Meanwhile, his lawyers announce that the suspect is supposedly non-binary. New report, eight House members, including the new number three in the Republican leadership, tried to stop the SEC investigation into the now collapsed crypto exchange, FTX. Judge says cap does not apply to the Alex Jones $49 million verdict in his Texas defamation case. That's got to hurt. Bolsonaro to challenge his election loss to Lula. The G7 seeks to put a price cap on Russian oil. Congress contemplates another continuing resolution to avoid a government shutdown in 3 weeks. And the Supreme Court okays the House committee to see Trump's taxes. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. It is the what I call Thanksgiving Eve, but what I know Emma calls
Hump Day.
Right.
Hello.
Yes.
That's what it is.
I am obligated to allow you to say your catchphrase.
Well, there you go. It happened, even though it is Thanksgiving Eve. I'm looking forward to Thanksgiving. I don't know about you.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Why not? Why wouldn't I? Patriots playing tomorrow night. I'm excited about that. I'm sure you're excited to watch three games of football.
Mm-hmm. Giants play, so I'm anxious about that. But that
do you
is...
even like eat, or do you just go? And,
yes.
And... All right. So you
I
do sit down.
Eat.
You don't just, but the game's on the whole time, right?
Yes, yes.
Okay, just checking.
Okay.
All right, let's check in on this. The killer in the, or suspected killer, we should say, in the Colorado Springs shooting in the Q bar is going to appear in court today. It is sort of stunning the amount of information we don't have on this person. Like generally what we see in these moments are like, we will hear like, you know, from his neighbor or his, coworker or, somebody else. And it's been there has been a lot of lack of information at this point. We know he's been charged with a hate crime, or I should say they have been charged with a hate crime. Their lawyer claims that they are non-binary and that they go by they, them. I think there's some reason to be at least skeptical, but, you know, going to, if that's what they claim, that is their pronouns, then that's the way that we'll address them.
Well, it should be noted that it's certainly possible that the shooter is non-binary, but that the tactic, that this tactic of trying to troll people in the media would be something quite consistent with right-wing hateful people online. So we don't know the full scope of it or the answers, but it would be consistent with that.
Well, and the same reason why, you know, we've been skeptical, you know, at least somewhat careful in terms of jumping to any conclusions throughout this time, it's the same reason why we should be so now. That the defense lawyers say something does not necessarily make it true. What we really need to see is some type of evidence, at least for those around them, that they identified this way. Nevertheless, and regardless, we've never known the motivation of this shooter. And it's, I mean, it may be relevant in terms of the relentless targeting and hatred associated with trans people, with gay people that we have seen from the right over the past year, 2 years. I mean, at a certain level, right? I mean, it doesn't matter why this person that did what they did, as much as, like, we know what the Republican Party and the right-wing media have been doing for the past 12, 24 months in terms of drumming this up. We can look at how much their expenditures are in a state like Michigan. The vast majority of their election commercials were focused on trans people and drag queens. We played this yesterday of Tucker Carlson saying that people should be armed. Of course, he would claim that he means it in the same way that it was said earlier, armed with documents about trans people and their grooming, et cetera, et cetera. But they're doubling down. They're doubling down on this. Here is Matt Walsh, the nobody who has made his fortune in transphobia, homophobia, in a theocratic sermonizing as to who gets to have sex and how, according to him. We have other footage of him now defining that what he thinks is legitimate sex and illegitimate sex. But here is this sex pest yesterday doubling down on his program on the Daily Wire. And let's just play this.
Family-friendly drag shows, quote-unquote, have two purposes. One, from the drag queen's perspective, is to satisfy their fetish for cross-dressing in front of children. The other, on a more macro level, is to indoctrinate children into queer theory. To put it simply, the point of Drag Queen Story Hour and the supposed family-friendly drag shows is to turn your children queer. That is the goal. And whenever you say that, what I just said right there is going to be clipped by Media Matters. Hello, everybody on Twitter. The people who invented it stated explicitly that that is the point, to help children live queerly. That's their quote. And the thing about the left is that
I don't know what live queerly means. If it means accepting the fact that there are gay people, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that.
Right.
Yeah. Well,
except for the fact that the high priest, Matt Walsh, says there's something wrong with it. Go ahead.
Sorry. No, I didn't mean to cut you off. It's just, I mean, like, that is how paper thin they feel like the line is between being queer and being straight for them, is that, like, oh, you just gaining acceptance of gay or trans people. It's just, it's going to create mayhem. No, what it does is it creates love and acceptance of gay and trans people.
Well, that's exactly that is exactly the point. That is exactly what they don't want.
Yep.
It is exactly, they do not want an iota of normalization of gay people. They do not want the existence of gay people to be considered normal. They want it to be obscene. They want it to be seen as problematic. They want to go back to where this country was 50, 60 years ago, where if you were gay, it was perceived as some type of disease. And that's why they talk about it as a disease. They do not want this to be accepted or normalized in society. And this is what a theocrat, this is what a high priest, this is what they do. They tell the rest of us, they tell the majority of society, I don't like the way that you express yourself sexually or identify yourself, and therefore I'm going to impose this on you, and any action that you take that in any way normalizes this behavior, whether it's like you're featuring gay people on television or they're reading a book or someone's dressed up reading a book. I mean, like, is the problem is just like we can't dress as if you're a man, you can't dress as a woman. If you're a woman, you can't dress as a man. You can dress as a bunny rabbit.
I mean, and the thing is, like, straight people go to drag shows and they leave straight. The only people that go to a drag show and leave gayer or more trans than they arrive were people who were repressed by the culture
already,
around them.
Right, right.
Continue with this.
Stated explicitly that is the point, to help children live queerly. That's their quote. And the thing about the left is that what they believe and what they do,
by left,
all of it is so horrifying, so perverse, so degraded, that if you just quote them, then you somehow sound like the crazy one. If you quote what they are saying, it sounds crazy just to say it out loud because it's so horrifying. Yet it's true. And this is the reason the left cares so much about this and they defend it so vigorously. Because according to the left, think about this. According to the left, the drag queen child combination has become dangerous. They say it's a lightning rod for violent backlash, right? That's what they said. And it's greatly exaggerated, of course. Mostly it's invented out of whole cloth, actually. But
no.
But even by their version of events, if it's causing this much chaos and violence, why do you insist on continuing to do it? If according to you, it's like putting people's lives out.
Understand what he's saying here. He's saying, if, and let's be clear, this is not just the left. This is the vast majority of people in this country. The vast
pediatric
majority.
Health professionals.
The vast majority of people. And let's be clear, people aren't defending trans people or drag queens or gay people because there's going to be a backlash. It is because we're defending them in the same way that we would defend anybody, because they have a right to exist, and Matt Walsh does not get a right to tell other people how they should express themselves sexually or identify themselves. He doesn't have that right. That's what we're pushing back against. It just so happens that their increased rhetoric is definitely putting people's lives in danger. And we should also say, continue for just 1 second. Go back just a little bit. I just want to get this last part.
For violent backlash, right? That's what they said. And it's greatly exaggerated, of course. Mostly it's invented out of whole cloth, actually. But even by their version of events, if it's causing this much chaos and violence, why do you insist on continuing to do it? If according to you, it's like putting people's lives at risk, If the effort to have men cross-dress in front of children is putting people's lives at risk, why are you still doing it? Is it that important to you?
This is, let's be clear, and you can see more examples of this. You can see it on Tucker Carlson. You can see it a bunch of places. You can see it with Tim Pool, all of them. This is a threat.
Mm-hmm.
If you people continue to do things like read books to children, then you can only expect more violence. This is a threat. Make no mistake about it. This is a threat. This is the same thing as Donald Trump getting up in front of the American public and going like, if the election doesn't go my way, you know, I can imagine some people are going to be upset and they may do things.
Look what you made me do. The gay club shooting edition.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah.
100%. Continue on with it.
Yeah.
It's like putting people's lives at risk. If the effort to have men cross-dress in front of children is putting people's lives at risk, why are you still doing it? Is it that important to you? Now, as always, they try to flip the burden around on us. They demand that we explain why we object to children being exposed to drag queens, and we can't explain it, and we have, and we will continue to, because it's very easy to explain. Drag is inherently sexual and ideological. It is not burlesque, true. And it's not appropriate to bring your child to a burlesque show.
Your child.
You disgusting freaks.
You know, people could make an argument that it is not appropriate to bring your child into a Catholic church, which has systematically protected child predators for decades upon decades upon decades. Now, I've never heard any, well, I mean, I guess I've heard some people say it, and there's an argument. Matt Walsh would light himself on fire if people started to say that. But let's look at this statistically. Let's look at how many people have been molested at a drag queen book reading versus inside a Catholic church with a priest. Let's look at it over the past 60 years. Let's look at it over the past 10. Let's look at the systematic protection of those people. Like, systematic. Over and over and over again. But you don't hear massive cries for people saying that if you bring your kids into a Catholic church, you're some type of freak. I mean, it does raise some questions about Matt Walsh. It really does. But we'll leave others to raise them. We're going to take a break in a second. When we do, we're going to be talking to Astrid Taylor. She's co-founder of the Debt Collective. Today's program sponsored by our favorite sponsor, SunsetLakeCBD.com. Right now, they're having a massive sale. All products, 30% off with the coupon code Friday. And Sunset Lake is using Black Friday into a fundraising opportunity for a great organization. If you visit SunsetLakeCBD.com, it's been all this week. All CBD products will be 30% off with the coupon code Friday. Like I said, all orders over $100 will receive a jar of CBD gummies free, a $40 value. And Sunset Lake CBD is going to donate 10% of the proceeds from this Black Friday sale to Feeding Chittenden. It is the largest emergency food provider in Vermont. These guys are based up near Burlington, feeding over 12,000 people each year. This is on the heels of what we did, I guess it was 2 weeks ago. They had an Election Day sale between the Majority Report and Sunset Lake CBD. We're going to be sending $2,500 each to Planned Parenthood. These guys are still at it. They have donated over $26,000 over the past year or two to anti-drug war organizations, to animal shelters, union strike funds, nature conservation, refugee resettlement, Give Directly, just an amazing a company. Their products are fantastic. Check them out. Tinctures, coffee, fudge, gummies with THC and CBD. Again, visit SunsetLakeCBD.com. Use the coupon code Friday. Take advantage of these deals. 30% off. Sale ends November 27th. Some restrictions may apply. So check it out. All right, quick break. When we come back, Astrid Taylor. We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Astra Taylor. She's the co-founder of the Debt Collective, author of her most recent book, Remake the World, Essays, Reflections, and Rebellions. Astra, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So today, maybe it was yesterday, I guess, the Biden administration announced that they are going to extend the existing, I guess, under the auspices of COVID, moratorium on student loan debt repayment for everybody until at least, I guess it would end in June, and then 60 days later of 2023, payments would come in. That is supposed to be timed until after the Supreme Court can address the appeal from the administration on two different court cases. Just walk us through briefly those two different court cases, and then, the claims that are made in those court cases, the problem with those court cases, and then we'll talk about the question of the authority under which the Biden administration has issued the debt forgiveness, $10,000 for each student, or I should say a borrower, $20,000 if you had a Pell Grant.
Yes. So I think first we want to parse the announcement from yesterday because it is contingent on multiple factors. And that is actually an unusual thing for the federal government to do, to say contingent on action from the court. So the premise is student debt payments will be turned back on 60 days after three things, one of three things. The Supreme Court rules, or debt is canceled, or June 30th. And whatever comes sooner, the payments will turn on 60 days after that. Okay. In my opinion, it should have been whatever happens the latest, let people plan, or just give a firm date. Because again, what's so hard for these, for the millions of debtors out there is, planning your life and knowing how much money is coming in and having that long-term ability to manage your own household budget. So, what is very important about this, though, is that, 60 days after the Supreme Court rules means that those are 60 days where, payments are paused, where the Biden administration could use one of the other legal authorities it has to cancel student debt. Right now, these cases that you mentioned are focused on the current plan from the administration, which was based on one authority. Again, there are many. The Department of Education cancels student debt all the time through various programs and through various legal bases. This is not unusual. This is not a radical act. They're taking issue with the specific authority that the Biden administration invoked for this, which is called the HEROES Authority. It's from 2003. And essentially, it says the Department of Education has the ability in periods of crises, in national emergencies, a la COVID, to relieve student debt burdens for people. So it is this specific pandemic connected authority that is in question. It is important to understand that this legal authority is clear. What the Biden administration did is absolutely legal. And I want to take a moment to savor how ridiculous and offensive these lawsuits are. So the one that is specifically spurring them to appeal to the Supreme Court, hardly a place that should be having the final word on this issue. This is the Supreme Court that has recently attacked bodily autonomy and rolled back abortion rights, is trashing the EPA and our ability to regulate the environment, right? Should not have the last word. But the case that is causing them to seek their judgment was instigated by six Republican-led states who basically said that a student loan servicer, a company called Mohila, which is based in Missouri, Mohila stands for Missouri, blah, blah, blah. It's a loan servicer based in Missouri, will lose revenue under the Biden administration's plan, right? The profits of this company will be harmed by canceling debt for borrowers. Representative Cori Bush, who is from Missouri, wrote a letter to Mohila clarifying their position, and they sent a formal letter back saying, "We have nothing to do with this litigation. This is not true." So essentially, pulling the rug out of from under this bogus legal argument. Nevertheless, the case is going. And so it's also important to say that a lower court dismissed this case for lack of standing, saying, "Look, this is ridiculous. This isn't a real case. Nobody is actually being harmed by student debt cancellation." It was appealed up to the Eighth Circuit, where there were three Republican judges, two appointed by Trump, one appointed by George W. Bush. So this case is ridiculous and should be dismissed. Another major piece of litigation out of Texas, which vacated the program, is equally offensive. Again, a Trump-appointed judge, very ideological. And this is a case teed up right with the Fifth Circuit, which is called, Elizabeth Warren called it the go-to court for conservative lawyers. And this case is brought about by a group calling themselves the Job Creators Network. It's actually a billionaire-backed front group that pretends to speak for small businesses. Guess who the main funder is? Bernard Marcus, the co-founder of Home Depot, who's a right-wing oligarch. It's also funded by Mercer Foundation family money, right? The Mercer family. Claiming to speak for small businesses, they found two eager plaintiffs who the argument they're giving is one of them's only eligible for $10,000 of relief. One of them has FFELP loans and so isn't eligible for cancellation under this program. They're saying, well, we're not getting the full benefits of this cancellation, so we want to sue to block it for everybody. And they have succeeded. So they're saying we're being harmed because we didn't get enough debt cancellation. Therefore, we will partner with these reactionary billionaires, kill the program, and tee it up again with that Fifth Circuit who we know will probably do more damage. So that's why these are so bunk and why we need to explore other options.
All right. Let me, and just one thing I'm unclear on. In the first case, right, I mean, there's a real question of standing there, particularly when the supposed these attorney generals are supposedly representing the interests of a company that has in no way made any claim anyways. So there's a real question of standing there. In the second case, I mean, maybe the standing is arguable, but none of these cases, it seems to me, have questioned the authority. It seems like that the judge in Texas basically took upon himself to question the authority, as opposed to addressing what the plaintiffs are arguing, which is that we're not getting enough relief. Instead, the judge took it upon himself to unilaterally decide, well, I'm going to go beyond the scope of what the question is before me and ask whether the statute authorizes any of this anyways, never mind whether it's been applied properly. And he's gone past, like, and I think this audience is somewhat familiar with the demise of the Chevron doctrine, which says that the court, and we're not quite there yet, but that courts usually defer when you have an ambiguity in a statute. The Heroes Act says, you know, if you're in some way impacted by an emergency, then the Department of Education has the ability to relieve some of this debt, you know. To the extent that, you know, how much of an emergency it needs to be. I mean, you know, 9/11 happened in a half a day. The implications may have resonated, and that's why the Heroes Act existed. COVID happened, you know, depending on how you want to measure it, months, maybe years, and how you want to measure what the impact is. I mean, there's a certain amount of vagueness. The Chevron doctrine usually allows agencies to deal with that. This guy in Texas decided to use the major questions doctrine, made up doctrine, didn't exist 10 years ago or 11 years ago, literally didn't, made up from whole cloth. He decides to apply that to a question that wasn't even raised, it seems to me. But be that as it may, that's where we're at this point. And the DOJ is asking the Supreme Court to address this on, like, what grounds? Like, what argument are they? Are they basically saying the Eighth Circuit, there's no standing, and in Texas, how are they attacking these claims?
Yeah, I think that they are going to go hard against the question of standing in the case that involved Mohila, the loan servicer. And again, the lower court was very clear about this and dismissed it outright for that reason and saying, look, there's no basis for harm for having that legal standing to bring this case. In Texas, the judge said, you know, some paradoxical things. So one complaint from these plaintiffs was not just that we didn't get enough debt relief, but it's also that we were denied the ability to participate in a period where we would be able to comment, right? And this HEROES Act, this emergency provision, does not require any notice and comment period, right? So they're complaining about something that this rule explicitly doesn't require. And in the judge's very brief opinion, he kind of contradicts himself and acknowledges that. He's like, well, they didn't get to have this, you know, the chance to comment on the laws, and it's also, but also it doesn't require that. And so, you know, it's quite a bizarre argument, which is why, you know, legal experts have said this is, you know, this is a logical pretzel. This is judicial overreach. You know, and this person is essentially trying to litigate, you know, create law to legislate from the bench, which is incredibly alarming. And so this is why, you know, I think we do have to put this whole fiasco, you know, in the perspective of the right wing takeover of the courts over the last 40 odd decades, probably longer than that, you know, and really ask what this means for progressive movements writ large, you know, because it ultimately is about so much more than student debt cancellation. And, you know, it's very important that to say, you know, this is, you know, this actually, we cannot just all roll over based on whatever the Supreme Court decides in the society anymore, especially, right, again, when there are all of these other legal avenues available. And we're talking about something very, you know, very mundane. We are talking about student debt cancellations. What will this mean for bigger fights ahead?
Well, do you have optimism at all, given Amy Coney Barrett's reluctance to hear those first two cases where she just essentially shot them down? I mean, it seemed, maybe I'm looking for silver linings where there are none, but that what's the sense of maybe the court's posture towards this?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm definitely, you know, not privy to any of the rationale that went into her refusing to see two previous lawsuits. It could have been that she was holding out for something that, you know, in her mind was more credible. I do think, you know, one thing that has been raised is that the conservative courts might not want to assent to these cases simply because they create such an open platform for standing. And it has been actually conservative legal scholars who for decades have said, no, unless you have personally, you know, lost, you know, a significant amount of revenue from, you know, an environmental disaster or, you know, a car accident or something, you don't have legal standing. Sorry. So these people, you know, they cannot prove any monetary damages. They really have no basis for suing. And, you know, it is actually, you know, the conservative legal world that has been pushing to restrict standing. So it could be, you know, that in some sort of twisted sense of their own sort of broader ideological self-interest, that they don't want to deal with these cases, not because they are on our side or because of any sense of justice.
That's a fascinating point. I should just say, you know, we cover a lot of tort cases. And one of the themes that have been happening over the past 10, 15, 20 years really is the Supreme Court basically shutting the door to the courthouse to a lot of claims across the board, saying you don't have standing here, so that you can't bring suits against government agencies, but also more primarily like even corporations. So okay, so that's the situation. We have no way of predicting. If I had to guess, based upon what I know of this court, they're going to find anything that they want to shoot it down. It's basically they start with the policy outcome, and then they reverse engineer it, as this judge in Texas did. There are some who claim that the use of this authority is indicative of the desire of the Biden administration to not actually relieve this debt. Talk about that a little bit, because I think it's clear. I mean, it's clear to me that the use of this authority was there is a reluctance. I'm not surprised by it. I would imagine by the Biden administration, as there was, like, there's a reluctance by the Biden administration to make the authority to do this explicit and open ended, because once you do 10,000 or 20,000. Under an authority that is not in any way temporally conditioned, then it creates more political pressure going forward to do this more often, right? I mean, if we're 10 years out from an emergency from COVID, you know, the authority that's used is not going to be used again, presumably, to cancel student debt. But if there's an explicit acknowledgement that the authority exists there since 1935, the act at, you know, from 35, I can't remember what it was now. It was you would know better than I.
The 1965 Higher Education
Act. Then that pressure can exist going forward. So talk about that that dynamic there.
Yeah. What's interesting, I mean, again, there are a range of legal authorities that can be used to cancel student debt. So the Debt Collective has been pushing for the last few years to have the president cancel student debt using the authority granted from by the Higher Education Act of 1965, which is a very broad authority. But much of our organizing has focused on students who were defrauded by predatory for-profit colleges, and we brought to light something called Borrower Defense to Repayment that says if your school broke state law that you're entitled to debt discharges. So that's how we've won billions and billions of dollars in this year alone for student debtors. There are other legal bases. People get debt forgiveness, as they call it, through income-driven repayment plans, through public service loan forgiveness. Again, this is not radical. But yes, I think there was absolutely an intention in the Biden administration not to use an authority that would be impossible, right? This wasn't them, you know, sort of saying
some nefarious plan.
Actually, it wasn't nefarious in that way. It was nefarious in the sense that they wanted to say this is limited, this is about the pandemic, because they're not willing. They're neoliberals. They're not willing to say education is a public good. We should cancel all this student debt. It's all immoral, and make college free for everybody. Right. That's what they're afraid of. They're
right.
The bigger framework movement that will push them to do it again and again. But the genie is out of the bottle. Debt's been canceled many, many times. We all know it can be canceled again and again. So, you know, they were fighting in that sense of losing battle. The real mistake they made is not the legal basis is important, but it actually was that they moved slowly. So advocates, including, you know, the Debt Collective, who are kind of on the you know, militant wing of things, but a lot of allies who are much more, you know, traditional, were very clear with the administration. You need to not have an application process. You need to not limit relief based on an income cap, because that doing that necessitates an application. And you need to move swiftly. So they took 6 weeks to release an application that was essentially a glorified Google document that cost the government $100 million to make, and every day bought their enemies time. And again, we are talking about lawsuits funded by billionaires who can, the Cato Institute had a lawsuit, they filed them in the perfect, you know, courts, teeing them up with the judges who will be sympathetic. They have deep, deep, deep pockets to do this, to find someone willing to say, yes, exactly as you said, to reverse engineer that policy ambition they have. And that was the mistake that I am incredibly angry about, was delaying when we should be governing, you know, the big we, the big tent that includes the Biden administration. Not that they want much to do with me and definitely don't take my advice, but knowing what we're up against, which is Republicans and right wing, you know, oligarchs who will do everything they can to stymie even a base, you know, a moat of a relief for working people. And so it was that slowness and that delay that really did this. And it's clear. So one thing, the last thing I'll say on this is in the hearings for these legal cases, the right wing plaintiffs, the lawyers were clear that if cancellation had just been done automatically and quickly, they could never claw it back. There's no way. They were like, thank God this is so long, because now we can stop it. So there are lessons here. One is, you know, and maybe the most important one is, you know, do your policy like you mean it. Words and deeds simultaneously.
There's two analogies that come to mind with this situation. One is that during in the American Rescue Act, they, instead of expanding Medicare to provide for health insurance people, they did it through COBRA. So, I mean, they provided free COBRA. If you're getting health insurance during that period of time, it is free to you. From the perspective of somebody who's getting, wants the material benefits of health insurance during that time, it was free to you. It was much more expensive for the U.S. government to do, but they did not want to set that precedent that you could expand Medicare. Because once you expand it once, people are like, hey, wait a second, why don't we continue to have that? Or at least they're afraid of people asking that question. And then the second analogy would be in the Build Back Better bill. They should have gone on that much quicker after the American Rescue Act. They should have done it a year earlier instead of like slowing things down. Because the one thing I think that we've learned in this context is that, and I think there is a will there by the Biden administration. I don't think it's because of the goodness of their hearts, but I think from a political standpoint, they understood the importance of it to at least give some student debt relief. But I think you're absolutely right. They didn't want to set a precedent that this could be extended and people would get the idea that you could do this at any time. Again, I think that's also a folly on their part as well, because people are, you know, that's the mindset that people have. But they also, like you say, they delayed in this where they could have just, and they could have just said, like, we have all the records. We know who's there. The only reason why they set up this application process, as easy it was, is to sort of say, like, let's see, maybe there's a bunch of people who don't really care about it. And we're talking about 45 million people. If 5 million didn't happen to follow the news or get it, then there's some, I guess, savings or whatnot. It's not as big as people said. And but they could have done it the like 48 hours after Biden announced it, and then facts on the ground, that's it. End of story. Move on to the next thing.
Absolutely. And again, you know, and we've seen this movie before. This is why I have a bit of optimism. You know, I wouldn't call it a silver lining, but, you know, optimism of the will. So again, I've worked for years with students at for-profit colleges. We organized the first student debt strike in 2015. The Obama administration trickled relief instead of, you know, it was well proven. And in fact, you know, the CFPB and other entities validated this. There was systemic fraud. They made every debtor individually prove they had been defrauded, you know, just one by one kind of picked people off. A lot of people didn't know that there was an application to submit, because that's what happens. Actually, the most vulnerable, the most in need of student debt relief often don't know what the process is. So they trickled out this relief. Trump took office. We spent 4 years fighting DeVos to you know, just hold ground. And in June of this year, the Biden administration is basically assented to our demands, the demands we had at the beginning. Cancel every penny for all these students automatically, immediately, no application, no delay. And they raised over $6 billion of debt for nearly 600,000 people. So we need to make that happen faster this time around by keeping up the fight and being relentless about, you know, this point that, you know, we cannot govern like it's, I don't know, 1993 or something.
Right.
And we have some time. We didn't have time then, actually. That's what we know today. We didn't have time then. And we definitely do not have time today.
Do you, I can appreciate why the Biden administration may not be too psyched to talk to you and keep you updated on what they're doing. But do you hear anything through your channels as to like what they're predisposed to do in the event that the Supreme Court says no? I mean, I, on one hand, like the idea of like punting seems like a bad idea to me. On the other hand, the closer we get to that next election, it seems to me the more pressure there is on them to at the very least deliver this, because it was by any way that you could measure, it was at the very least not a political liability whatsoever. And it was more than likely a political benefit. I mean, it seems like for them, in their punting this, they're putting it into play in the next election and that they're going to need to do this.
Yeah, no, I think this is the thing. They've also sent they sent emails out over the last 48 hours to millions of people saying your application was approved. Yes, it's tied up in the courts. People are counting on this. The president of the United States, the Department of Education have given their word and said, you applied for relief, you know, and we approved you for it. And it was not a political liability. The people who said it was going to be were, let's name some names, Larry Summers, Jason Furman, the, you know, neoconservative economist, Matthew Iglesias, you know, saying, oh, this is going to be so horrible. People get their debts canceled. You know, there's going to be this centrist backlash and a right-wing backlash. Oh, to the contrary, a recent poll.
Not even a hair. The thing was, it wasn't even a 24-hour news cycle, how quickly it went away.
Well, and people loved it. I mean, polling just, just said 60% of voters under the age of 30 said it was either very important or the only reason they voted. And we're talking about elections that were won by, you know, small margins. And so you could, you know, make a case that student debt cancellation helped hold the Senate, you know, that helped stem that anticipated red tide. So I think they're really playing with fire by letting people down. The debt collective, as we do, is organizing a debt strike and saying, look, you can never turn on payments for debts the president of the United States has promised to cancel. No, we can't pay and we won't pay. And we're going to have to keep fighting. I mean, They've never given a penny of relief out of the goodness of their hearts. Debtors have always had to organize to raise the political stakes. But here the political stakes are clear and they are electoral. And there's data to back us up. We always said this is going to be a popular thing. People are weighted down by these loans. Generations ago, it was not like this. And people know that. People who don't have student debt have loved ones and friends who have it. This is a popular pocketbook policy. And so I really think the Biden administration, we have leverage to force them to deliver on this, and they have the legal authority to do so. We will not accept a future where a right-wing Supreme Court or these lower courts, full of lifetime appointees put in place by people like Donald Trump, get to decide whether, ultimately whether we live or die. Because this is, again, about more than student debt relief. It's about, the habitability of the environment. So no. We need to govern creatively and figure out how to provide the things people need, to not just survive, but to thrive.
Astra Taylor, co-founder of the Debt Collective. Where can people get more information if they want to in some way help with these with this pushback?
Debtcollective.org, always and forever, especially, sign up for texting these days since Twitter seems dicey, but we're also on Twitter at Strike Debt.
Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Sarah Moran, she is the U.S. Country Director for Give Directly. We'll be right back after this. We are back, Sam Seder, Emma Viglin on the Majority Report. Joining us now, Sarah Moran. She is the U.S. Country Director for Give Directly. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I love your charity. I was just asking, maybe it was a year or two ago, we were doing some ads for GiveWell. And I went to GiveWell to find, and that's where I found Give Directly. No relationship other than Give, I guess, in your first name. And tell us what Give Directly does, at least broadly speaking. And then we'll talk about the sort of like the theory behind it.
Yeah, definitely. So Give Directly does exactly what it says on the box. We give unconditional cash to people living in extreme poverty around the world. We've been doing that for over a decade, and we've reached over 580 million people in those 10 years with unconditional cash. That's all we do.
And it's just, to me, it's like the most straightforward thing that a charity could possibly do. And yet, from my experience, there's like a lot of resistance to this kind of concept, rooted in like paternalism and condescension, frankly. Like, was circumventing that stuff paramount for your guys and your founding and your mission?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think we were founded by economists who saw the opportunity to make a really strong economics argument about why cash works and how it works for people. The idea behind the founding of Give Directly was to take the most direct line to alleviating poverty. And if poverty is defined by how much income you have, then giving people income will definitionally raise them out of poverty. But I think in the 10 years that we've been working, there have been over 300 studies that have shown other positive impacts of cash on health, on education, on family dynamics, intimate partner violence, all sorts of things. So the spillover effects of cash are huge. And I think that's been a big reason that we've been able to get momentum around this work is, yes, it sounds kind of too good to be true, but there are a lot of positive impacts that you can see.
Yeah, that's what I really like about your charity is that it's a twofer insofar as you're providing material benefit for people obviously living in extreme poverty, but you're also showing this dynamic that really, I mean, other charities are great. I contribute to other charities, but the application of like you're proving something. And we've seen a lot of examples to it, but before we get to that aspect of it, because I want to talk about it, because you also are involved in I don't know if you in particular, but in experiments that are going on around the country on this. But talk about like where the money has gone over the past 10 years, and give us a sense of like of how it has materially benefited people.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, GiveDirectly has distributed about $580 million. About $200 million of that, just over, has gone to people living in poverty in the United States. And the balance, $380 million plus, has gone to people living in poverty, in extreme poverty around the world. And we were started in Kenya, founded in Kenya, did a lot of our early work there, have since expanded to 11 countries, many of which are on the African continent where, you know, dollars go really far, and where a lot of people are living under the World Bank poverty line of $2.15 a day. I think we've worked across different contexts, and what we've seen universally, regardless of whether you're working in a high income country or a low income country, is that people spend the money on to first meet their basic needs. You know, in the US, that's paying their bills, that's buying groceries, that's paying for childcare. And internationally, it's also investing in assets, productive assets, you know, rebuilding their houses, buying cows, getting better stock for the stores that they run. And so, you know, what we've seen across all of our programs is the direct impact on the people receiving the funds. But we've also seen spillover impact in the communities where we're working. And so, you know, one of the things that's really exciting about our work is one of our studies showed that there was a multiplier effect, that actually injecting cash into a community had a 2.6x multiplier effect on the kind of, you know, income of that community. And I think that's also where, you know, again, we want to continue to make the argument that cash is not only the most direct way to support individuals, but that actually there can be community impact as well.
Will you expand a little bit on that multiplier effect? Like, I'm not sure that everybody is aware of what that means. And sure. I mean, we hear it in the context of a lot of different of unemployment insurance or something to that effect. But will you just like walk us through what that means? And is it different in, or have you been able to study? Because my intuition is that the implications of this money in an extreme poverty situation in, let's say, in Kenya is different than it is in maybe, you know, a town in West Virginia. Will you walk us through those two things?
Definitely. So for the spillover effect first, I think the bottom line is if you give one person $1, the basic idea is giving one person $1 creates $2.60 of contribution to the local economy. And we've seen that primarily in our overseas program. I think this particular study was from Kenya. What it basically shows is that, you know, you give a woman who runs a shop extra money. She improves the quality of the goods she's selling at that shop. That pulls in additional business. There's a flywheel effect there. People are coming to the shop, people are spending more. And where we work, we saturate entire communities, which means we're not just giving that one woman $1,000. We're giving everyone in that community $1,000, which then means people are able to spend money at that shop. And that creates this sort of positive effect where we've seen that spill.
How does it grow? I mean, because I'm not sure that people understand. Like, so,
sure.
Okay, so she upgrades her goods, and that attracts people in with their money. But you've given, you know, that money on both ends. But then the shop owner hires more people who then make money and then go spend it at other places. And it just grows the economy, essentially.
Exactly. And you're pulling in more people, you're pulling in more shops, you're making a kind of creating more vibrant economic space. Yeah.
And so now compare that to when we give money in the States, because in most instances, like, you may have more of an opportunity if you're in Kenya and you're living in a rural area. We're going to buy two extra goats. That means more milk. We can sell some of the milk. We can drink some of the milk. And it has that, you know, what people say, like, you're teaching them to fish instead of giving them fish. How does that rate relative to, let's say, in this country?
Yeah, well, when you're talking about our traditional programs in places like Kenya, we're giving very large amounts of money to people, and we're usually giving it to them sort of at one time. So, you know, we're giving $1,000 one time to a household, which, depending on, you know, exactly how much income people have, can be between 1 and 3 years income for them. And so it's a massive injection of capital to those families. And to do the equivalent in the United States would be prohibitively expensive for an organization like us to consider. We're talking about $30,000 to $50,000 kind of one-time injection. So what you've seen, I think, in the US is a push towards what we call guaranteed income, which is not necessarily these transformational amounts of funds, but they're funds that can help people smooth their spend, deal with volatility, make small investments in them, you know, in themselves and their families, meet their basic needs on a month-to-month basis. Those are usually smaller amounts. I think a lot of the projects that you see in the U.S. that are testing this guaranteed income are looking at between $500 and $1,000 a month. And so, you know, it's not enough for you to go and buy a house, but it is enough for you to spend down some of your debt, to meet your bill needs, you know, to pay your bills, to get your kids their school books. And so it's a slightly different approach. And I think the result is that we see different outcomes. I think the biggest outcomes that we see in the US is reduced volatility. You know, people are able to plan farther in ahead. They know that they can meet their basic needs month to month. But you're not necessarily seeing those catalytic changes where people are actually, you know, investing in a house and then building wealth out of that money.
I would imagine there's also some marginal differences, though, in the sense of, like, if I know I'm getting $500 a month, if I know I'm getting, you know, $750 a month, I can begin to save, and maybe I'm buying an $8,000 car instead of a $2,500 car. And then 3 years down the line, my expenses that I've spent on repairing it have gone down. And this is the dynamic of having a little bit extra cash can actually save you money. Because it's cheaper. It's more expensive to be, to live in poverty dollar for dollar than it is to live in wealth, because you can afford to sort of, like, you know, pay up front for certain things. You're not paying interest rates on them. You're buying a higher quality product. And so you have less sort of maintenance costs down the road.
No, it's exactly right. And I think those are exactly the results we are looking to see in the projects we're running here in the US. So we are administering three of the country's largest guaranteed income programs right now. We're working with the city of Chicago on a $30 million guaranteed income program that's going to reach 5,000 people. We're working with Cook County, Illinois, on a $42 million project that's going to reach 3,250 people. But that one is 2 years long. The Chicago project is 1 year long, and we're working with a local partner called the Georgia Resilience and Opportunity Fund in Georgia to run a guaranteed income program for Black women. And so across all of those projects, it's exactly what we're hoping to see, is that people can take these marginal amounts of money we're giving on a monthly basis and actually, over the course of a year or 2 years, to your point, make investments that will be better for them in the long term, and will again kind of get into that flywheel effect. So yeah, that is definitely our hope. you know, there are a lot of studies ongoing right now in the U.S. on exactly this question. There's really only one who's starting to release their final results, and that's the Stockton demonstration, the SEED demonstration, that saw a lot of what you're talking about. It saw people actually be able to get better jobs, better paying jobs, because there was a little bit of that financial stress taken away, which gave them some space to actually go out on a limb, find something that's better paying. And so in the long term, they're going to be significantly better off.
And that was Michael Tubbs, right?
Yeah, that's right.
The mayor who ended up sadly losing his race. There's some issues associated with that race. That was, I guess, a couple of years ago. But even in Hudson, New York, where I spend some time, there's a UBI program there as well. Just to be clear, well, I have two questions. One is, to what extent is there, and this area seems a little bit dicey to me, like how much advice, training, education in terms of like how to make a more of a multiplier effect from this money is there? And are you guys involved in that, or are there agencies that you pair with? And then also how does this impact existing social safety nets, and how do you make sure that those are not implicated? Because people say like, whoa, you don't need food stamps now because you're getting this.
Exactly right. So on the first question, you know, we generally come from the point of view that, you know, poor people actually are, they know best how to spend their money, and that any incremental dollar, they know exactly where it's going to go. So we generally shy away from the sort of more patronizing view that you need to teach people how to spend their money better, and that they're poor because of some choices that they're making themselves. You know, that is not GiveDirectly's view. Having said that, we have heard actually from recipients in our programs that when we're giving them large lump sums, they would not mind to have a little bit of support in thinking about how to make the most of that money. So that's actually feedback we've gotten from people. And as a result, we often will offer sort of what we call cash plus support. So it's optional, voluntary, people can opt in to get additional like financial support if they feel like they want it and would help their dollars go farther. So we're definitely open to it, but we don't impose that on people. And our, you know, the whole point of our work is that it's unconditional. And then I think your second question around the social safety net, I think this is a huge question for a lot of people who are doing cash domestically. You know, we have worked with in our two largest projects with the city of Chicago and with Cook County. You know, working with government actually has massive benefits there. We were able to seek protections to make sure that people's participation in this project, that the money that we are giving them as a grant, as a gift, would not be taxable and would not, you know, take away from their existing benefits, would not be seen as income. But that's something that I think we were able to do because we were working closely with government. And I think the broader community, this is something that a lot of organizations are battling with. And I think there's a lot of work being done to seek federal guidance and federal support to make sure that, you know, state administered benefits are actually looking at these programs as something that we really want to test incrementally, you know, whether or not these funds are going to be helping people, not just as a replacement for the existing social safety net.
Well, that's what's so key about like the UBI debate generally. Yeah. I mean, that's why, just to make it a little political, we were skeptical here about Andrew Yang, because yes, his proposal was as a supplement, or not as a supplement, but as a replacement. And so I'm curious, you know, your organization's been around for over a decade. Mm-hmm. So how has the national conversation around mm-hmm. UBI affected your work and openness from some people maybe in government? But also then you have like just capitalists trying to say, oh, this could be a beneficial way to replace certain programs that might be a little costly for taxpayers, et cetera. Oh. Hold on, we lost your audio really quickly.
She's frozen.
Yeah, let's see if we can get her back.
Andrew Yang did not want her to answer that question.
I know. And
we're
wow.
reconnecting with her right now. But that is, I mean, that's exactly what I was thinking. I couldn't remember Yang's name, frankly. And I'm
well, he was photographed with Ted Cruz at the crypto conference yesterday, so...
I'm thankful I forgot his name. But I mean, I think he was on Dave Rubin, actually, where he sort of revealed, like, eventually we'll be able to get rid of all of, like, mm-hmm. the social welfare programs.
I think
all
we
right,
might
we have Sarah's back.
Sarah
okay.
back, yeah. Sarah, can you hear us?
Sorry. Yeah, I got you. Can you get
that's
me?
That's okay.
Yep.
Yes. Great.
Awesome.
Did you hear my question?
Yeah, sorry about that. I did. You were asking about, you know, how things have changed over the last decade. And I think broadly, you know, I want to reiterate that guaranteed income has been something on the agenda since the 60s, if not before. And I think, you know, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. talked about it in his book, From Chaos to Community, Where We Go From Here. And so, yes, we've definitely seen an acceleration in the conversations around UBI in the last decade. But you also have things like the Alaska Dividend Fund that's been running since the 70s, which is probably the closest thing we actually have in the United States to an actual universal basic income. I think the conversations today are really thinking more practically about, you know, if you have limited resources, how do you distribute it in a way that's going to have the most impact? Is that actually a universal basic income, or is that something that's more targeted to particular people who might have been left out of economic progress for one reason or another? And I think that's where you get arguments around, you know, what we call guaranteed income, which is generally more targeted. It may not be something that's enough for people to live on, but it is definitely something that might lift people out of, you know, a circumstance where they're not able to actually get, you know, get their feet from underneath them.
How much was the results from the expansion of the earned of the child tax credit? How much of that? Because we cut child poverty in this country by what is it, over 50%
or 40%? Yeah, yeah.
And it seems to me it did two things. One, it showed like the efficacy of giving people money in terms of taking people out of poverty. It also showed that we tolerate maybe not even the word. We have poverty in this country as a policy choice. We can decide not to have poverty. We just decide to have poverty.
Well, you know, the thing I think about with the child tax credit is that the evidence is overwhelming that it had an incredible impact on poverty, and especially children's poverty, to your point. You know, you were talking about the Hudson Project. You know, one of the things that I get excited about with that is it's 5 years long. You know, we have a lot of guaranteed income pilots happening right now, 1 year, 2 years in duration. And that's awesome. I think it's going to contribute to important evidence. But I also think that if you're telling someone that you're going to get income for 5, 10, 15 years, like we're doing with one of our, you know, we're running a 12-year universal basic income project in Kenya. And that is the kind of thing where, you know, with the expansion of the child tax credit, it was on the political chopping block. People didn't know whether or not it was going to get extended or not. And so it's a lot harder for people to conceptualize what it would mean for them to get that guaranteed income for a longer period of time. So I think there's a huge opportunity for us to think differently about that in the U.S. And I do think that, you know, there is at some point a conversation around, you know, do we actually have enough evidence? And I think we would say we're pretty close to having a lot of evidence around cash. We don't really think we need to run, you know, 100 new studies to prove that cash works. And so the question is, how do you then convert that into something where you can actually get broad-based buy-in for those kinds of policies?
Well, Sarah, I really appreciate your coming on. Where can people, if they want to give directly, where would they go to do so?
Great. Yeah, we'd love to encourage people coming up to the holidays. If you're looking for an alternative way to give a gift, come to givedirectly.org. You can give there. You can choose programs that you want to contribute to. You can also set up fundraisers. So those are really easy ways for people to sort of crowd in support. And those dollars, you know, 90 cents on every dollar that we raise go directly to people experiencing extreme poverty. So really would love to, get people excited about that. And especially just given how overwhelming the negative news cycle can be, this is a great way to have a really direct impact. And we love to see people flowing to our page. It's givedirectly.org.
All right, Sarah Moran, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Awesome. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
All right, folks. Going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will take your phone calls. And we will read your IMs, and we will do some, like, what do you call it? Like, video clips.
Yes.
Yeah, those.
What's my jigs?
Yeah, we'll do all that stuff. Don't forget, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only help the show survive and thrive, but you get the free show free of commercials. And then you get the fun half full of fun, sometimes free of fun. But more often than not, fun.
Well, yesterday was a dark day, but we still found time to have fun at the expense of
red-faced Brett Weinstein.
Yeah,
yes, so actually, that was fun. That was
pretty much almost always an element of fun.
I'm still dining on that, I have to say.
It was wonderful.
That could be a feast. I may not even have room for turkey. don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Emma, big football day tomorrow. Also, you know, Thanksgiving, but for you, I mean, that's like,
who cares?
Yeah.
I will say that, my Thanksgiving plans, I had two options of a place to go. One place where I knew football would not be watched. One place where I knew it would be. And I'm going to the latter. So I will be able to comment on, some of the games that we'll be discussing today in ESPN OT. Bradley and I, we want to get out of here a little early, so pretty much right after the show ends, we're going to be streaming on youtube.com/ESPN show. Given our picks, this is the first week in a while where I beat Bradley by one game, and it's kind of, you know, pathetic because Bradley went 0-3. We'll be discussing that, as well as Zach Wilson being benched for the Jets and the Nets falling to Philly last night, which I think has a lot of interesting storylines. So check us out, youtube.com/ESPN show.
Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leck Media?
In Matlock Media, we had last night Danny Bessner on Left Reckoning to talk about first-person shooters and the Pentagon's interest in your gaming there. And also we talked about some venture. Sam, you know what HODL means, right, in the crypto sense?
Of course.
So, like, HODLing.
Just tell other people.
Okay, yeah. So basically this idea that you have this digital asset, let's call it, or, you know, funny money, and you're going to hold it for a long time. You're not just going to try to sell that for cash. And, you know, people like Binder and myself have always been saying, like, that's a lie that they're telling you, so they hold on to their things while they sell. And
exactly.
We played a clip last night of the venture capitalist David Sachs and a few other guys, Jason Calacanis, who funded the Jason Boudin recall, basically last year before the crash, laughing about how they are, A, getting the stuff at a discount before it's publicly available, and then B, selling it before they actually say to get, you know, sweet fiat currency, which is what we're all after. So we played a clip of that. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning to watch Dave and I talk about that.
Yeah, just to be clear, so my strategy of buy and hold on crypto has been a mistake?
Yeah, it turns out that's not actually the soundest investment advice. Hmm. And the best is to, like, you know, when you have a healthy profit in dollars, unload those.
Get out.
The F out of there.
Yeah. So Matt's, like, your Matt's MLM, the Matt Leck Media.
We're solid.
Discussing another MLM.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Well, I mean, yeah, a different kind, but yeah.
To hear about this MLM, Matt, you have to recruit 10
mistake.
More people.
I made a huge mistake.
Sam's got a
mistake.
Lot of NFTs.
I put a lot of... I did NFTs of pictures I took of my Bitcoin account.
And you somehow thought those were going to be as valuable as, like, a Babe Ruth rookie card in 30 years.
I mean, just wait for that. That's all I thought.
Hey, the underlying technology is pretty impressive.
Yes, exactly. All right, folks. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
You see, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
Lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on. What? Come on. What? Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total.
Pussy.